Lasagna. Another day, it's chocolate chip cookies, brownies, creme brulee. Alba is in heaven. More dessert, she begs. We poach eggs and salmon, make pizza from scratch. I have to admit that it's kind of fun, but I'm terrified the first night I cook dinner by myself. I'm standing in the kitchen, surrounded by pots and pans. The asparagus is overcooked, and I burn myself taking the monkfish out of the oven. I put everything on plates and bring it into the dining room, where Henry and Alba are sitting at their places. Henry smiles encouragingly. I sit down. Henry raises his glass of milk in the air. To the new cook! Alba clinks her cup against his, and we begin to eat. I sneak glances at Henry, eating. And as I'm eating, I realize that everything tastes fine.
It's good, Mama,
Alba says, and Henry nods. It's terrific, Claire, Henry says, and we stare at each other, and I think, don't leave me.
What goes around comes around. Monday, December 18th, 2006, and Sunday, January 2nd, 1994. Henry is 43. I wake up in the middle of the night with 1,000 razor-toothed insects gnawing on my legs, and before I can even shake a Vicodin out of the bottle, I'm falling. I double up. I'm on the floor, but it's not our floor. It's some other floor, some other night. Where am I? Pain makes everything seem shimmery, but it's dark, and there's something about the smell. What does it remind me of? Bleach. Sweat. Perfume so familiar. But it couldn't be. Footsteps walking upstairs. Voices. A key unlocking several locks. Where can I hide? The door opens. I'm crawling across the floor as the light snaps on and explodes in my head like a flashbulb, and a woman whispers, Oh my God. I'm thinking, No, this just can't be happening. And the door shuts, and I hear Ingrid say, Celia, you've got to go. And Celia protests, and as they stand on the other side of the door arguing about it, I look around desperately, but there's no way out. This must be Ingrid's apartment on Clark Street, where I have never been, but here is all her stuff, overwhelming me. The Eames chair, the kidney-shaped marble coffee table loaded with fashion magazines, the ugly orange couch we used to... I cast around wildly for something to wear, but the only textile in this minimal room is a purple and yellow afghan that's clashing with the couch, so I grab it and wind it around myself, hoist myself onto the couch, and Ingrid opens the door again. She stands quietly for a long moment and looks at me, and I look at her, and all I can think is, Oh, Ing, why did you do this to yourself? The Ingrid who lives in my memory is the incandescent blonde angel of cool I met at Jimbo's 4th of July party in 1988. Ingrid Carmichael was devastating and untouchable, encased in gleaming armor made of wealth, beauty, and ennui. The Ingrid who stands looking at me now is gaunt and hard and tired. She stands with her head tilted to one side and looks at me with wonder and contempt. Neither of us seems to know what to say. Finally, she takes off her coat, tosses it on the chair, and perches at the other end of the couch. She's wearing leather pants. They squeak a little as she sits down. Henry. Ingrid. What are you doing here? I don't know. I'm sorry, I just... Well, you know... I shrug. My legs hurt so much that I almost don't care where I am. You look like shit. I'm in a lot of pain. That's funny. So am I. I mean physical pain. Why? For all Ingrid cares, I could be spontaneously combusting right in front of her. I pull back the afghan and reveal my stumps. She doesn't recoil, and she doesn't gasp. She doesn't look away, and when she does, she looks me in the eyes, and I see that Ingrid, of all people, understands perfectly. By entirely separate processes, we have arrived at the same condition. She gets up and goes into another room, and when she comes back, she has her old sewing kit in her hand. I feel a surge of hope, and my hope is justified. Ingrid sits down and opens the lid, and it's just like the good old days. There's a complete pharmacy in there with the pincushions and thimbles. "What do you want?" Ingrid asks. "Opiates." She picks through a baggie full of pills and offers me an assortment. I spot Ultram and take two. After I swallow them dry, she gets me a glass of water and I drink it down. "Well..." Ingrid runs her long red fingernails through her long blonde hair. "When are you coming from?"
"December 2006.
What's the date here?" Ingrid looks at her watch.
"It was New Year's Day, but now it's January 2nd, 1994.
"Oh, no. Please, no."
"What's wrong?" Ingrid says.
"Nothing." "Today is the day Ingrid will commit suicide. What can I say to her? Can I stop her? What if I call someone?"
"Listen, Ing, I just want to say..."
I hesitate. What can I tell her without spooking her? Does it matter now? Now that she's dead? Even though she's sitting right here?
"What?"
I'm sweating.
"Just... be nice to yourself. Don't... I mean, I know you aren't very happy. Well, whose fault is that?"
Her bright red lipsticked mouth is set in a frown. I don't answer.
"Is it my fault? I don't really know."
Ingrid is staring at me as though she expects an answer. I look away from her. I look at the Mohoi Nagy poster on the opposite wall.
"Henry," Ingrid says, "why were you so mean to me?"
I drag my eyes back to her. "Was I? I didn't want to be." Ingrid shakes her head.
"You didn't care if I lived or died." "Oh, Ingrid."
"I do care. I don't want you to die."
"You didn't care.
You left me, and you never came to the hospital." Ingrid speaks as though the words choke her. "Your family didn't want me to come. Your mom told me to stay away."
"You should have come."
I sigh. "Ingrid, your doctor told me I couldn't visit you.
I asked, and they said you never called."
"I called. I was told you didn't want to talk to me and not to call anymore." The painkiller is kicking in. The prickling pain in my legs dulls. I slide my hands under the afghan and place my palms against the skin of my left stump and then my right.
"I almost died, and you never spoke to me again."
"I thought you didn't want to talk to me. How was I supposed to know?
You got married, and you never called me, and you invited Celia to the wedding to spite me."
I laugh. I can't help it.
"Ingrid, Claire invited Celia. They're friends."
I've never figured out why. Opposites attract, I guess. But anyway, it had nothing to do with you. Ingrid says nothing. She's pale under her makeup. She digs in her coat pocket and brings out a pack of English ovals and a lighter.
"Since when do you smoke?" I ask her.
Ingrid hated smoking.
Ingrid liked coke and crystal meth and drinks with poetic names.
She extracts a cigarette from the pack between two long nails and lights it. Her hands are shaking. She drags on the cigarette and smoke curls from her lips.
"So, how's life without feet?" Ingrid asks me. "How'd that happen, anyway?"
"Frostbite. I passed out in Grand Park in January."
"So how do you get around?"
"Wheelchair, mostly."
"Oh, that sucks."
"Yeah," I say, "it does." We sit in silence for a moment. Ingrid asks,
"Are you still married?"
"Yeah."
Kids?
One.
A girl. Oh.
Ingrid leans back, drags on her cigarette, blows a thin stream of smoke from her nostrils.
I wish I had kids.
You never wanted kids, Ing.
She looks at me, but I can't read the look. I always wanted kids.
I didn't think you wanted kids, so I never said anything.
You could still have kids.
Ingrid laughs.
Could I?
Do I have kids, Henry? In 2006, do I have a husband and a house in Winnetka and 2.5 kids?
Not exactly. I shift my position on the couch. The pain has receded, but what's left is the shell of the pain. An empty space where there should be pain, but instead there is the expectation of pain.
Not exactly,
Ingrid mimics.
How not exactly? Like as in, not exactly, Ingrid? Really, you're a bag lady?
You're not a bag lady.
So, I'm not a bag lady. Okay, great.
Ingrid stubs out her cigarette and crosses her legs. I always loved Ingrid's legs. She's wearing boots with high heels. She and Celia must have been to a party. Ingrid says,
we've eliminated the extremes. I'm not a suburban matron, and I'm not homeless. Come on, Henry, give me some more hints.
I am silent. I don't want to play this game.
Okay, let's make it multiple choice. Let's see. A, I'm a stripper in a real sleazy club on Rush Street. B, I'm in prison for axe murdering Celia and feeding her to Malcolm. Yeah. C, I'm living on the Rio del Sol with an investment banker. How about it, Henry? Do any of those sound good to you?
Who's Malcolm?
Celia's Doberman.
Figures. Ingrid plays with her lighter, flicking it on and off.
How about D, I'm dead?
I flinch.
Does that appeal to you at all?
No, it doesn't.
Really? I like that one best.
Ingrid smiles. It's not a pretty smile. It's more like a grimace.
I like that one so much that it's given me an idea.
She gets up and strides across the room and down the hall. I can hear her opening and shutting a drawer. When she reappears, she has one hand behind her back. Ingrid stands in front of me and says,
surprise!
And she's pointing a gun at me. It's not a very big gun. It's slim and black and shiny. Ingrid holds it close to her waist, casually, as though she's at a cocktail party. I stare at the gun. Ingrid says,
I could shoot you.
Yes, you could, I say.
Then I could shoot myself, she says.
That could also happen.
But does it?
I don't know, Ingrid. You get to decide.
Bullshit, Henry. Tell me,
Ingrid commands. All right. No, it doesn't happen that way. I try to sound confident.
Ingrid smirks. But what if I want it to happen that way?
Ingrid, give me the gun.
Come over here and get it.
Are you going to shoot me? Ingrid shakes her head, smiling. I climb off the couch, onto the floor, crawl toward Ingrid, trailing the Afghan, slowed by the painkiller. She backs away, holding the gun trained on me. I stop.
Come on, Henry, nice doggy. Trusting doggy.
Ingrid flicks off the safety catch and takes two steps toward me. I tense. She's aiming point blank at my head. But then Ingrid laughs and places the muzzle of the gun against her temple.
How about this, Henry? Does it happen like this?
No.
No.
She frowns.
Are you sure, Henry?
Ingrid moves the gun to her chest.
Is this better? Head or heart, Henry?
Ingrid steps forward. I could touch her. I could grab her.
Ingrid kicks me in the chest and I fall backward. I'm sprawled on the floor looking up at her, and Ingrid leans over and spits in my face. "Did you love me?" Ingrid asks, looking down at me. "Yes," I tell her.
"Liar,"
Ingrid says, and she pulls the trigger.
Monday, December 18th, 2006. Claire is 35. Henry is 43. I wake up in the middle of the night and Henry is gone. I panic. I sit up in bed. The possibilities crowd into my mind. He could be run over by cars, stuck in abandoned buildings, out in the cold. I hear a sound. Someone is crying. I think it is Alba. Maybe Henry went to see what was wrong with Alba, so I get up and go into Alba's room. But Alba is asleep, curled around Teddy, her blankets thrown off the bed. I follow the sound down the hall, and there, sitting on the living room floor, there is Henry, with his head in his hands. I kneel beside him. "What's wrong?" I ask him. Henry raises his face, and I can see the shine of tears on his cheeks in the streetlight that comes in the windows. "Ingrid's dead," Henry says. I put my arms around him. "Ingrid's been dead for a long time," I say softly. Henry shakes his head. "Years, minutes, same thing," he says. We sit on the floor in silence. Finally, Henry says, "Do you think it's morning yet?" "Sure." The sky is still dark. No birds are singing. "Let's get up," he says. I bring the wheelchair, help him into it, and wheel him into the kitchen. I bring his bathrobe, and Henry struggles into it. He sits at the kitchen table, staring out the window, into the snow-covered backyard. Somewhere in the distance, a snowplow scrapes along a street. I turn on the light. I measure coffee into a filter, measure water into the coffee maker, turn it on. I get out cups. I open the fridge, but when I ask Henry what he wants to eat, he just shakes his head. I sit down at the kitchen table opposite Henry, and he looks at me. His eyes are red, and his hair is sticking out in many directions. His hands are thin, and his face is bleak. "It was my fault," Henry says. "If I hadn't been there..."
"Could you have stopped her?"
I ask.
"No, I tried."
"Well, then..." The coffee maker makes little exploding noises. Henry runs his hands over his face. He says,
"I always wondered why she didn't leave a note."
I am about to ask him what he means when I realize that Alba is standing in the kitchen doorway. She's wearing a pink nightgown and green mouse slippers. Alba squints and yawns in the harsh light of the kitchen.
"Hi, kiddo," Henry says.
Alba comes over to him and drapes herself over the side of his wheelchair.
"Morning," Alba says.
"It's not really morning," I tell her. "It's really still nighttime."
"How come you guys are up if it's nighttime?"
Alba sniffs.
"You're making coffee, so it's morning."
"Oh, it's the old coffee equals morning fallacy," Henry says. "There's a hole in your logic, buddy."
"What?" Alba asks. She hates to be wrong about anything.
"You are basing your conclusion on faulty data. That is, you are forgetting that your parents are coffee fiends of the first order, and that we just might have gotten out of bed in the middle of the night in order to drink more coffee." He's roaring like a monster, maybe a coffee fiend.
"I want coffee," says Alba. "I am a coffee fiend."
She roars back at Henry, but he scoops her off of him and plops her down on her feet. Alba runs around the table to me and throws her arms around my shoulders.
"Roar!"
she yells in my ear. I get up and pick Alba up. She's so heavy now.
"Roar yourself!"
I carry her down the hall and throw her onto her bed, and she shrieks with laughter. The clock on her nightstand says 4:16 a.m. "See?" I show her. "It's too early for you to get up." After the obligatory amount of fuss, Alba settles back into bed, and I walk back to the kitchen. Henry has managed to pour us both coffee. I sit down again. It's cold in here.
"Claire?"
"Hmm?"
"When I'm dead..."
Henry stops, looks away, takes a breath, begins again.
"I've been getting everything organized, all the documents, you know, my will and letters to people and stuff for Alba. It's all in my desk. I can't say anything. Henry looks at me. When? I ask. Henry shakes his head. Months? Weeks? Days? I don't know, Claire. He does know. I know he knows. You looked up the obituary, didn't you? I say. Henry hesitates, and then nods. I open my mouth to ask again, and then I am afraid.
Hours, if not days. Friday, December 24th, 2006. Henry is 43. Claire is 35. I wake up early, so early that the bedroom is blue in the almost dawn light. I lie in bed listening to Claire's deep breathing, listening to the sporadic noise of traffic on Lincoln Avenue, crows calling to each other, the furnace shutting off. My legs ache. I prop myself up on my pillows and find the bottle of Vicodin on my bedside table. I take two, wash them down with flat Coke. I slide back into the blankets and turn onto my side. Claire is sleeping face down with her arms wrapped protectively around her head. Her hair is hidden under the covers. Claire seems smaller without her ambience of hair. She reminds me of herself as a child, sleeping with the simplicity she had when she was little. I try to remember if I've ever seen Claire as a child sleeping. I realize that I never have. It's Alba that I'm thinking of. The light is changing. Claire stirs, turns toward me, onto her side. I study her face. There are a few faint lines at the corners of her eyes and mouth that are the merest suggestion of the beginnings of Claire's face in middle age. I will never see that face of hers, and I regret it bitterly. The face with which Claire will go on without me, which will never be kissed by me, which will belong to a world that I won't know, except as a memory of Claire's, relegated finally to a definite past. Today is the 37th anniversary of my mother's death. I have thought of her, longed for her every day of those 37 years, and my father has, I think, thought of her almost without stopping. If fervent memory could raise the dead, she would be our Eurydice. She would rise like Lady Lazarus from her stubborn death to solace us. But all of our laments could not add a single second to her life, not one additional beat of the heart nor a breath. The only thing my need could do was bring me to her. What will Claire have when I am gone? How can I leave her? I hear Alba talking in her bed.
Hey, says Alba. Hey, Teddy, shh, go to sleep now.
Silence.
Daddy?
I watch Claire to see if she will wake up. She's still asleep.
Daddy?
I gingerly turn, carefully extricate myself from the blankets, maneuver myself to the floor. I crawl out of our bedroom, down the hall, and into Alba's room. She giggles when she sees me. I make a growling noise, and Alba pats my head as though I'm a dog. She is sitting up in bed in the midst of every stuffed animal she has. Move over, Red Riding Hood. Alba scoots aside, and I lift myself onto the bed. She fussily arranges some of the toys around me. I put my arm around her and lean back, and she holds out Blue Teddy to me.
He wants to eat marshmallows.
It's a little early for marshmallows, Blue Teddy.
How about some poached eggs and toast?
Alba makes a face. She does it by squinching together her mouth and eyebrows and nose.
Teddy doesn't like eggs, she announces.
Shh, Mama's sleeping.
Okay,
Alba whispers loudly.
Teddy wants blue jello.
I hear Claire groan and start to get up in the other room. Cream of wheat? I cajole. Alba considers.
With brown sugar?
Okay.
You want to make it? I slide off the bed.
Yeah. Can I have a ride?
I hesitate. My legs really hurt. And Alba's gotten a little too big to do this painlessly. But I can deny her nothing now. Sure, hop on. I'm on my hands and knees. Alba climbs onto my back, and we make our way into the kitchen. Claire is standing sleepily by the sink, watching coffee drip into the pot. I clamber up to her and butt my head against her knees, and she grabs Alba's arms and hoists her up, Alba giggling madly all the while. I crawl into my chair. Claire smiles and says, "What's for breakfast, cooks?"
"Jello!"
Alba shrieks. "Mmm, what kind of jello? Cornflake jello? No! Bacon jello? Yuck!" Alba wraps herself around Claire, pulls on her hair.
"Ouch, don't, sweetie." "Well, it must be oatmeal jello, then. Cream of wheat!"
"Cream of wheat jello, yum!" Claire gets out the brown sugar and the milk and the cream of wheat package. She sets them on the counter and looks at me inquiringly. "How about you? Omelette jello?" "If you're making it, yeah." I marvel at Claire's efficiency moving around the kitchen as though she's Betty Crocker, as though she's been doing this for years. She'll be okay without me, I think, as I watch her. But I know that she will not. I watch Alba mix the water and the wheat together. And I think of Alba at 10, at 15, at 20. It is not nearly enough yet. I am not done yet. I want to be here. I want to see them. I want to gather them in my arms. I want to live. "Daddy's crying," Alba whispers to Claire.
"That's because he has to eat my cooking," Claire tells her, and winks at me. And I have to laugh.
New Year's Eve, 2. Sunday, December 31st, 2006. Claire is 35, Henry is 43. 7:25 p.m. We're having a party. Henry was kind of reluctant at first, but he seems perfectly content now. He's sitting at the kitchen table showing Alba how to cut flowers out of carrots and radishes. I admit that I didn't exactly play fair. I brought it up in front of Alba, and she got all excited, and then he couldn't bear to disappoint her. "It'll be great, Henry. We'll ask everyone we know." "Everyone?" he queried, smiling. "Everyone we like," I amended. "And so for days I've been cleaning, and Henry and Alba have been baking cookies, although half the dough goes into Alba's mouth if we don't watch her. Yesterday, Charisse and I went to the grocery store and bought dips, chips, spreads, every possible kind of vegetable, and beer and wine and champagne, little colored hors d'oeuvre toothpicks and napkins with Happy New Year printed in gold and matching paper plates and Lord knows what else. Now the whole house smells like meatballs and the rapidly dying Christmas tree in the living room. Alicia is here washing our wine glasses. Henry looks up at me and says, "Hey, Claire, it's almost showtime. Go take your shower." I glance at my watch and realize that, yes, it's time. Into the shower and wash hair and dry hair and into underwear and bra, stockings and black silk party dress, heels, and a tiny dab of perfume and lipstick and one last look in the mirror, I look startled and back into the kitchen where Alba, oddly enough, is still pristine in her blue velvet dress and Henry is still wearing his holy red flannel shirt and ripped-up blue jeans. "Aren't you going to change?" "Oh, yeah, sure. Help me, huh?" I wheel him into our bedroom. "What do you want to wear?" I'm hunting through his drawers for underwear and socks.
"Whatever. You choose."
Henry reaches over and shuts the bedroom door. "Come here." I stop riffing through the closet and look at Henry. He puts the brake on the wheelchair and maneuvers his body onto the bed. "There's no time," I say.
"Right. Exactly. So let's not waste time talking."
His voice is quiet and compelling. I flip the lock on the door. "You know I just got dressed."
"Shh."
He holds out his arms to me, and I relent and sit beside him. And the phrase, "one last time," pops into my mind unbidden.
8:05 p.m. The doorbell rings just as I'm knotting my tie. Claire says nervously, "Do I look all right?" She does. She is pink and lovely, and I tell her so. We emerge from the bedroom as Alba runs to answer the door and starts yelling,
"Grandpa! Grandpa! Kimmy!"
My father stomps his snowy boots and leans to hug her. Claire kisses him on both cheeks. Dad rewards her with his coat. Alba commandeers Kimmy and takes her to see the Christmas tree before she even gets her coat off.
"Hello, Henry," says Dad, smiling, leaning over me, and suddenly it hits me. Tonight, my life will flash before my eyes. We've invited everyone who matters to us. Dad, Kimmy, Alicia, Gomez, Charisse, Philip, Mark and Sharon and their kids. Graham, Ben, Helen, Ruth, Kendrick and Nancy and their kids. Roberto, Catherine, Isabel, Matt, Amelia. Artist friends of Claire's, library school friends of mine. Parents of Alba's friends, Claire's dealer, even Celia Atley at Claire's insistence. The only people missing have been unavoidably detained. My mother, Lucille, Ingrid, oh, God, help me.
8:20 p.m. Gomez and Charisse come breezing in like kamikaze jet fighters.
"Hey, library boy, you lazy coot, don't you ever shovel your sidewalks?" Henry smacks his forehead. "I knew I forgot something."
Gomez dumps a shopping bag full of CDs in Henry's lap and goes out to clean the walks. Charisse laughs and follows me into the kitchen. She takes out a huge bottle of Russian vodka and sticks it in the freezer. We can hear Gomez singing "Let It Snow" as he makes his way down the side of the house with the shovel. "Where are the kids?" I ask Charisse.
"We parked them at my mom's. It's New Year's. We figured they'd have more fun with Grandma. Plus, we decided to have our hangovers in privacy, you know? I've never given it much thought, actually. I haven't been drunk since before Alba was conceived."
Alba comes running into the kitchen, and Charisse gives her an enthusiastic hug.
"Hey, baby girl, we brought you a Christmas present."
Alba looks at me.
"Go ahead and open it."
It's a tiny manicure set, complete with nail polish. Alba is open-mouthed with awe. I nudge her, and she remembers.
"Thank you, Aunt Charisse."
"You're welcome, Alba."
"Go show Daddy," I tell her, and she runs off in the direction of the living room. I stick my head into the hall, and I can see Alba gesturing excitedly at Henry, who holds out his fingers for her as though contemplating a fingernailectomy.
"Big hit," I tell Charisse.
She smiles. "That was my trip when I was little. I wanted to be a beautician when I grew up." I laugh.
"But you couldn't hack it, so you became an artist."
"I met Gomez and realized that nobody ever overthrew the bourgeois capitalist misogynist corporate operating system by perming its hair. Of course, we haven't exactly been beating it to its knees by selling it art, either."
"Speak for yourself, babe. You're just addicted to beauty, that's all."
"Guilty, guilty, guilty." We wander into the dining room, and Charisse begins to load up her plate.
"So what are you working on?" I ask her.
"Computer viruses as art."
"Ooh. Oh, no. Isn't that kind of illegal?"
"Well, no. I just design them, then I paint the HTML onto canvas, then I have a show. I don't actually put them into circulation."
"But someone could."
"Sure." Charisse smiles wickedly. "I hope they do." Gomez scoffs. "But some of these little paintings could seriously inconvenience the World Bank and Bill Gates and those bastards who make ATM machines."
"Well, good luck. When's the show?"
"May. I'll send you a card."
"Yeah, when I get it, I'll convert our assets into gold and lay in bottled water."
Charisse laughs. Catherine and Amelia arrive, and we cease to speak of world anarchy through art and move on to admiring each other's party dresses.
8:50 p.m. The house is packed with our nearest and dearest, some of whom I haven't seen since before the surgery. Leah Jacobs, Claire's dealer, is tactful and kind. but I find it difficult to withstand the pity in her gaze. Celia surprises me by walking right up to me and offering her hand. I take it, and she says, "I'm sorry to see you like this."
"Well, you look great," I say, and she does. Her hair is done up really high, and she's dressed all in shimmery blue.
"Uh-huh," says Celia in her fabulous toffee voice. "I liked it better when you were bad, and I could just hate your skinny white self."
I laugh. "Ha-ha, the good old days." She delves into her purse.
"I found this a long time ago in Ingrid's stuff. I thought Claire might want it."
Celia hands me a photograph. It's a photo of me, probably from around 1990. My hair is long, and I'm laughing, standing on Oak Street Beach, no shirt. It's a great photograph. I don't remember Ingrid taking it, but then again, so much of my time with Ing is kind of a blank now. "Yeah, I bet she would like it. Memento mori." I hand the picture back to her. Celia glances at me sharply.
"You're not dead, Henry de Tamble."
"I'm not far from it, Celia."
Celia laughs. "Well, if you get to hell before I do, save me a place next to Ingrid."
She turns abruptly and walks off in search of Claire.
9:45 p.m. The children have run around and eaten too much party food, and now they are sleepy but cranky. I pass Colin Kendrick in the hall and ask if he wants to take a nap. He tells me very solemnly that he'd like to stay up with the grown-ups. I am touched by his politeness and his 14-year-old's beauty, his shyness with me, even though he's known me all his life. Alba and Nadia Kendrick are not so restrained.
"Mama," Alba bleats, "you said we could stay up."
"Sure you don't want to sleep for a while? I'll wake you up right before midnight."
"No."
Kendrick is listening to this exchange, and I shrug my shoulders and he laughs. The indomitable duo. "Okay, girls, why don't you go play quietly in Alba's room for a while?" They shuffle off, grumbling. We know that within minutes they'll be playing happily. "It's good to see you, Claire," Kendrick says, as Alicia ambles over.
"Hey, Claire, get a load of Daddy."
I follow Alicia's gaze and realize that our father is flirting with Isabel.
"Who is that?"
"Oh, my God," I'm laughing. "That's Isabel Burke." I start to outline Isabel's draconian sexual proclivities for Alicia. We are laughing so hard we can hardly breathe.
"Perfect. Perfect. Oh, stop,"
Alicia says. Richard comes over to us, drawn by our hysterics.
"What's so funny, belladonnas?"
We shake our heads, still giggling.
"They're mocking the mating rituals of their paternal authority figure," says Kendrick.
Richard nods, bemused, and asks Alicia about her spring concert schedule. They wander off in the direction of the kitchen, talking Bucharest and Bartok. Kendrick is still standing next to me, waiting to say something I don't want to hear. I begin to excuse myself, and he puts his hand on my arm.
"Wait, Claire."
I wait.
"I'm sorry," he says.
"It's okay, David." We stare at each other for a moment. Kendrick shakes his head, fumbles for his cigarettes.
"If you ever want to come by the lab, I could show you what I've been doing for Alba."
I cast my eyes around the party, looking for Henry. Gomez is showing Sharon how to rumba in the living room. Everyone seems to be having a good time, but Henry is nowhere in sight. I haven't seen him for at least 45 minutes, and I feel a strong urge to find him, make sure he's okay, make sure he's here. "Excuse me," I tell Kendrick, who looks like he wants to continue the conversation. "Another time, when it's quieter." He nods. Nancy Kendrick appears with Colin in tow, making the topic impossible anyway. They launch into a spirited discussion of ice hockey, and I escape.
9:48 p.m. It has become very warm in the house, and I need to cool off. So I'm sitting on the enclosed front porch. I can hear people talking in the living room. The snow is falling thick and fast now, covering all the cars and bushes, softening their hard lines and deadening the sound of traffic. It's a beautiful night. I open the door between the porch and the living room.
Hey, Gomez!
He comes trotting over and sticks his head through the doorway.
Yeah, let's go outside. It's fucking cold out there.
Come on, you soft, elderly alderman. Something in my tone does the trick.
All right, just a minute.
He disappears and comes back after a few minutes wearing his coat and carrying mine. As I'm angling into it, he offers me his hip flask.
Oh, no thanks. Vodka puts hair in your chest.
Clashes with opiates.
Oh, right, how quickly we forget.
Gomez wheels me through the living room. At the top of the stairs, he lifts me out of the chair, and I'm riding on his back like a child, like a monkey. And we are out the front door and out of doors, and the cold air is like an exoskeleton. I can smell the liquor in Gomez's sweat. Somewhere out there behind the sodium vapor, Chicago glare, there are stars.
Comrade.
Hmm? Thanks for everything. You've been the best. I can't see his face, but I can feel Gomez stiffen beneath all the layers of clothing.
What are you saying?
My own personal fat lady is singing, Gomez. Time's up. Game over.
When?
Soon.
How soon?
I don't know. I lie. Very, very soon. Anyway, I just wanted to tell you, I know I've been a pain in the ass every now and then. Gomez laughs, but it's been great. I pause because I'm on the verge of tears. It's been really great. And we stand there, inarticulate American male creatures that we are, our breath freezing in clouds before us, all the possible words left unspoken now. And finally I say, let's go in. And we do. As Gomez gently replaces me in the wheelchair, he embraces me for a moment, and then walks heavily away without looking back.
10:15 p.m. Henry isn't in the living room, which is filled with a small but determined group of people trying to dance in a variety of unlikely ways to the squirrel nut zippers. Charisse and Matt are doing something that looks like the cha-cha, and Roberto is dancing with considerable flair with Kimmy, who moves delicately but steadfastly in a kind of foxtrot. Gomez has abandoned Sharon for Catherine, who whoops as he spins her and laughs when he stops dancing to light a cigarette. Henry isn't in the kitchen, which has been taken over by Raoul and James and Lourdes and the rest of my artist friends. They are regaling each other with stories of terrible things art dealers have done to artists and vice versa. Lourdes is telling the one about Ed Keenholz making a kinetic sculpture that drilled a big hole in his dealer's expensive desk. They all laugh sadistically. I shake my finger at them. Don't let Leah hear you, I tease. Where is Leah? Cries James. I'll bet she has some great stories. He goes off in search of my dealer, who is drinking cognac with Mark on the stairs. Ben is making himself tea. He has a Ziploc baggie with all sorts of foul herbs in it, which he measures carefully into a tea strainer and dunks into a mug of steaming water. Have you seen Henry? I ask him. Yeah, I was just talking to him. He's on the front porch. Ben peers at me. I'm kind of worried about him. He seems very sad. He seemed, Ben stops, makes a gesture with his hand that means I might be wrong about this. He reminded me of some patients I have when they don't expect to be around much longer. My stomach tightens. He's been very depressed since his feet. I know. But he was talking like he was getting on a train that was leaving momentarily, you know. He told me... Ben lowers his voice, which is always very quiet, so that I can barely hear him. He told me he loved me and thanked me, I mean, people, guys, don't say that kind of thing if they expect to be around, you know? Ben's eyes are swimming behind his glasses, and I put my arms around him, and we stand like that for a minute, my arms encasing Ben's wasted frame. Around us, people are chattering, ignoring us. I don't want to outlive anybody, Ben says. Jesus, after drinking this awful stuff and just generally being a bloody martyr for 15 years, I think I've earned the right to have everybody I know file past my casket and say, "He died with his boots on," or something like that. I'm counting on Henry to be there, quoting Donne, "Death be not proud, you stupid motherfucker. It'll be beautiful." I laugh. Well, if Henry can't make it, I'll come. I do a mean imitation of Henry. I raise one eyebrow, lift my chin, lower my voice. One short sleep past, we wake eternally. And Death shall be sitting in the kitchen in his underwear at 3 in the morning, doing last week's crossword puzzle. Ben cracks up. I kiss his pale, smooth cheek and move on. Henry is sitting by himself on the front porch in the dark, watching it snow. I've hardly glanced out the window all day, and now I realize that it's been snowing steadily for